The Fairbanks Four walk out of a courtroom, free men, after an unscheduled hearing this afternoon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's case for slashing the oil and gas tax credit program.
We've encouraged a lot of folks to look at Alaska who might not otherwise have done so simply by paying two-thirds of their cost. That's an extraordinary bonus.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
By 4:30 this afternoon, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner reported a Superior Court judge has approved a settlement that throws out the indictments and murder convictions of the Fairbanks Four, George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, all in the 1997 beating death of teenager John Hartman. Roberts is currently out on parole, but the other three were ordered to be released today after 18 years behind bars. More than 150 people gathered outside the Fairbanks courtroom this afternoon, where the unscheduled hearing took place. The men and prosecutors in the case had been working on a proposed deal to free them. The three Alaska Native men and an American Indian have always maintained their innocence in the death of 15-year-old John Hartman. Governor Bill Walker's budget proposal rolled out last week includes taxes on everything from fishing to tourism to gasoline, plus the first income tax in Alaska in 35 years. It also includes cuts to popular programs like home heating assistance, pre-K grants, winter road maintenance, and, yes, the permanent fund dividend. As the governor himself said, there is plenty for everyone in Alaska to dislike. But one reason the cuts aren't deeper and the taxes aren't steeper is because the governor's budget also gets about $500 million from the oil and gas industry. His proposal would slash the state's system of oil and gas tax credits, APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
Okay, so here's the state's problem in two numbers. First, $3.4 billion a year. That's how much the state averaged in oil and gas production taxes over the last decade. Now, $180 million. That's how much the state expects to collect next year. It's a 95% drop, mostly the result of plunging oil prices. And it's the main culprit in the state's $3.5 billion budget deficit. Ken Alper is the director of the state tax division.
Even if we didn't want to change things, we can't afford it.
And that's essentially the governor's position. Something's got to give. Because here's another number. $500 million. That's about how much the state paid out to oil and gas companies in refundable tax credits last year. Those credits are aimed at smaller companies, and they're designed to encourage new exploration and development. And they've worked, Alper says.
And in some ways we've been successful, but in some ways we've almost been too successful.
Too successful in that the state is now paying out more in tax credits to some companies than it takes in as production taxes from the whole industry. The governor's budget tries to fix what his administration sees as this imbalance. His plan has three main parts. First, raise taxes. It would increase the minimum tax on oil and gas companies from 4% to 5% and close a loophole that allows companies to use credits to dip below that 4% floor. Part two, cut credits. Right now, there are two main types of refundable credits, those based on your expenses and those based on your losses. If a company, say one of those drilling in Cook Inlet, stacks those credits, it can get reimbursed for 65% of its costs. Alper says that's too much.
Realistically, we've encouraged a lot of folks to look at Alaska who might not otherwise have done so simply by paying two-thirds of their costs. That's an extraordinary bonus. So our feeling is, if we could just ratchet that down to an affordable number, if we're paying one-third of a company's costs, we might get just as much bang for half as much buck.
The governor's plan would leave in place credits for operating losses, but it would get rid of the credits for drilling and exploration, allowing some to expire in 2016 and repealing others. And that brings us to part three, the loan fund. In place of credits, the governor wants to offer low-cost loans. The administration would use about $200 million in state savings to endow a fund run by ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Marcia Davis is deputy chief of staff to Governor Walker.
So that means it's going to cover a pad and road, or it'll cover a well, or it'll cover disposal facilities. It'll cover a chunk of infrastructure.
The loans would be aimed at those companies that came into the state recently, perhaps drawn by the credit program, and found oil and gas, and now need some help getting over the hump into actual production. It's not nearly enough to fund a whole project, but the administration hopes it could complement private financing. So what's the reaction from the industry?
This is the number one thing on everyone's radar.
That's Kara Moriarty, director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. She says companies are already being battered by low oil prices. If Alaska changes its tax regime yet again, it would hit the industry hard, she says.
I had one member say, you know, if the governor changes the tax system again, it is the fifth major tax change his company has experienced in 10 years.
The big question, of course, is how this plan will fare with lawmakers who gather in Juneau next month. Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel chairs the Senate's Natural Resources Committee, and she's not thrilled with what she's hearing. She argues that for every dollar the state pays out in credits, it will get back significantly more in royalties and economic activity down the line. Giesel does want to harden the minimum tax floor, though not raise it, and she agrees that maybe credits shouldn't be stackable.
And there's a discussion that I would be delighted to have, but that's not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, as has been verbalized.
Across the aisle, Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, had a different baby-themed metaphor.
Certainly is a step in the right direction, you know, but it's baby steps. It's like crawling.
Willikowski says the governor's plan doesn't go far enough. Among other changes, he wants to increase the minimum tax to more than 12%. That idea probably won't get far in the Republican-controlled legislature. Whether the governor's plan gets any farther remains to be seen. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
Blue Crest Energy plans to drill for oil in Cook Inlet's Cosmopolitan oil fields from the shore just north of Anchor Point. There's also a chance the company will place a rig in the water to drill for natural gas, but the debate over the state's tax credits are making Blue Crest hesitate. KBVI's Quinton Chandler has more.
Blue Crest is accepting the risks of drilling for oil, but they won't move on gas until they have more information. Larry Burgess, the Health and Safety Environmental Manager for Blue Crest, says the company is taking a wait-and-see approach.
Some of it depends on the tax credit structure. Some of it depends on the gas market itself, being able to sell the gas, and some of it depends on the price of gas. So right now, it is not something we're working on, but it is part of this project that we want to develop.
Blue Crest can't influence the market, but the company would like the state to leave its oil and gas tax incentives as they are. Burgess says the state already struck a deal with Blue Crest on tax credits for oil production, but the credits for gas could still change.
They don't have to remain strictly as they're written, but they need to supply the same benefits to us in a tax structure. So if that is what turns out, then that's good for us.
Blue Crest has to decide by spring of 2016 whether they will develop the gas reserves or they will lose the Spartan 151, the only drill rig in Alaska available to do the work. The Spartan 151 is owned by Spartan Offshore Drilling.
And they are waiting on Blue Crest to make a decision. And if we don't use it, the Spartan 151 could leave Cook Inlet. And that would leave no options to drill offshore.
Burgess says Spartan is spending about $20,000 per day to hold the rig in Resurrection Bay near Seward. He claims if Blue Crest leases the 151, they can eventually produce between 60 and 70 million cubic feet of gas per day for up to 30 years. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Salvation Army reports more requests for assistance across the state.
I've checked in with folks in Southeast and up into the Mat-Su Valley and the interior, and pretty much across the board, we're seeing a trend of increased need.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Each December, there is a spike in impaired driving-related accidents. Consider the real costs of driving impaired. It could result in the loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
Congressional leaders have agreed on a year-end spending and tax package with final votes expected soon. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Alaska can claim a number of victories in national defense, veterans benefits, and labeling guidelines for genetically engineered salmon.
FDA shall not allow the introduction or delivery into interstate commerce of any food that contains genetically engineered salmon until FDA has published final labeling guidelines for informing consumers of this content.
Essentially, no genetically engineered salmon would be on store shelves until the Federal Food and Drug Administration develops and implements a labeling process. It appears to be a step short of a clear labeling mandate. Other fisheries provisions would preclude marketing non-Alaskan or non-American fish as Alaska pollock. Another measure supports the J-1 and H-2B visa programs to help the state's fish industry fill its large number of seasonal jobs. Murkowski says commitments to the Alaska Native community were also fulfilled through funding to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service.
We also have, for the first time ever, included funding for tribal courts in Alaska. We see funding for substance and drug abuse funding within BIA that will not only work to deal with issues related to substance abuse, but domestic violence, suicides.
She also says contract support costs, which are the operational costs for tribes to deliver federal programs, are fully funded. The package holds funding flat for the Environmental Protection Agency. But Murkowski says there will be funding for the agency's backhaul program to remove solid waste and garbage from rural Alaska. The deal also delays for 2 years the implementation of the Affordable Care Act's Cadillac tax, which taxes high-cost insurance plans that are especially prevalent in Alaska. Congress is also expected to lift the crude oil export ban in the bill, though Alaska's oil was already exempt. The entire package is expected to clear Congress on Friday before lawmakers leave for their Christmas break. A federal judge has set an April trial date in a case that could affect state campaign contribution limits in Alaska. U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Burgess said the trial is estimated to take 5 days. It's scheduled to start April 25th, about 4 months before the state's primary elections. An Anchorage State Republican Party district and others are suing leaders of the Alaska Public Offices Commission, challenging the constitutionality of certain campaign contribution limits. The lawsuit challenges the $500 limit on individual contributions to candidates as too low and challenges the annual aggregate limit a candidate can solicit or accept from non-residents. The Department of Law, which is representing the commission, has asked that the case be dismissed. A state court heard oral arguments yesterday in a case involving the contentious lease on the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
The case's plaintiff, attorney Jim Gottstein, owns the building next to the LIO and alleges financial improprieties in the lease agreement between lawmakers and the property's landlord, which could invalidate the space's 10-year lease. Gottstein also argues that as a whistleblower, he should be compensated 10% of what's saved if the lease is terminated. Attorneys for the legislature and the building landlord don't dispute that there were financial overages associated with the LIO building, but they say the case is not a referendum on impropriety in the building's development and lease. Instead, attorney Kevin Cuddy told the judge that the claims were invalid because Gottstein knew about the financial excesses but waited more than a year to file his claim.
Instead of taking appropriate action, raising these questions to the Legislative Affairs Agency when something could be done, he decided to get a few dollars on his own and try to get some payments for construction-related work, and then sue the Legislative Affairs Agency and the other defendants.
The lawsuit is separate from ongoing legislative decisions about whether to relocate from the LIO to the state-owned Atwood building a few blocks away, but both touch on accusations of wasted money and government corruption. The Legislative Council is scheduled to meet on Saturday to take up the issue. Superior Court Judge Patrick McKay is considering the case and weighing next steps. He said more than once that the topic of the LIO building is a moving target, with a Saturday meeting of the Legislative Council likely to affect the status of the lawsuit. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The National Chamber of Commerce says African-American students still lag significantly behind their peers. A study it conducted in collaboration with the NAACP covered every state in the United States. But as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the study's results for Alaska may be flawed.
The U.S. Chamber's study looked at grades 4 and 8 in reading and math, as well as graduation rates and ACT test scores. In almost every category, Alaska's African-American students perform more poorly than the national average. However, in 4th grade reading and 8th grade math, Alaska outscored its national peers. Michael McShane, who helped the Chamber design and analyze the study, says the sample size in Alaska presents some problems.
About 131,000 students in Alaska, only about 4,500 are African American.
But McShane says no matter what the sample size, the takeaway from the study is not enough African American students are meeting with academic success. Steve Atwater agrees it's regrettable anytime there's a performance disparity in education. Atwater is University of Alaska Fairbanks' Dean of the School of Education. He says school districts are strong at evaluating students' performance early on and trying to get kids on track. Also, he says kids need to be evaluated in context.
Not all children learn in the same way, and that a close attention to the local context, the local cultural, is a way to perhaps enhance learning.
Atwater also says there are socioeconomic factors that influence student performance, factors educators have little control over. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Faced with a multi-billion dollar budget gap, nearly every agency in the state is looking at ways to cut spending. The state boards of fish and game are no exception, and last week held a joint meeting to talk about what could be cut. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
The message in public testimony was clear. Whatever cuts are made, don't reduce the public's access to the rulemaking process for fish and game. Gary Stevens spoke on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council.
We're not at all interested in helping the department diminish the public's opportunity to participate in the regulatory process by supporting any cuts to board. We have a hard time understanding why any of the cuts need to come out of the statutorily protected public process of regulating fish and game.
There was no specific action on the table at the December 9th meeting. Instead, it was meant to give the boards a better sense of public sentiment on a wide range of possible cuts, from reducing how often the Board of Fish discusses every region to getting rid of the free coffee at meetings. Dillingham's Gary Klein summed up much of the testimony.
Don't move the 3-year cycle to 5-year cycles. I do agree that it is too long, mainly because the decisions made at these meetings have such a huge impact on our Alaskan residents.
Testifiers also talked about the need to preserve the advisory committee process, including having in-person meetings and having fish and game staff on hand to participate. Some, including Dillingham's Gayla Hossett, also say any effort to streamline the proposal process shouldn't come at the expense of public participation.
In regards to the proposal process, I think that individuals should still be able to submit proposals, but I really do think that one voice is a strong voice. Because one voice could make a difference and a change, and I don't want it to where we don't have that voice anymore.
A few also suggested new revenue sources for the boards and for fish and game in general, like using the permanent fund reserve to pay for counting towers. Mark Richards is the chair of the Alaska Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which is working on another new source of revenue.
And rather than look at cuts, we would like the game side to look at producing more revenue via that hunting license increase.
No action was taken at the meeting. The committee will get together again in January for further discussion. By then, they're expected to have more results from a survey looking for public input on cuts, and more information from a Fish and Game operational review. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Ruth Ann's Restaurant, a Craig landmark, burned down early this morning. According to a press release issued by the Craig police, the fire was first reported at about 2:40 a.m. Fire personnel responded within minutes and found the building completely engulfed in flames. All occupants of that and nearby buildings were safely evacuated. Craig City Manager John Bowling says Ruth Ann's was significant not only to the people of Craig, but also visitors.
Probably not an exaggeration to say it was a Craig landmark. When people thought of going to Craig and going out to dinner, I mean, Ruth Ann's was usually the first thing that came to people's mind. The establishment was popular with locals as well as with local fishermen and visiting fishermen, folks up here for the summer or even the off-season dive fisheries as well. I think the business was well-known among the fishing fleet.
Bowling says it is a great loss to the community.
It's a loss of quite a few jobs for the folks that work there. And like any landmark in a community, especially a small community that gets destroyed unexpectedly, it's probably fair to say it's a shock.
Crews from the Craig and Klawock fire departments responded. The cause of the fire is under investigation, although no criminal actions are suspected. It's been a hard year for some Alaskans. Salvation Army branches around the state report significantly more requests for holiday assistance than last year. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on how the 3,000-resident southeast fishing community of Petersburg is responding to the need.
Petersburg Salvation Army Community Center is collecting toys for about 70 children this holiday season. That's up quite a bit from last year's 50. About 85 families, including about 230 people, will get boxes of food. Those numbers are up, too. Lieutenant Misty Burke shares pastoring duties with her husband, John.
A lot of families who were just really counting on a great fishing season this year didn't have that, and so they've not been able to do all the things that they wanted to do and not have enough money to pay off everything that they needed to pay off, and so they now are in a place where they're just struggling.
And it's not just Petersburg. Ivy Sponholz of the Salvation Army's Alaska office says the same is true in the state's other 17 missions.
I've checked in with folks in Southeast and up into the Mat-Su Valley and the interior, and pretty much across the board we're seeing a trend of increased need.
She says so far, community response has been good. Burke says that's been true for Petersburg's Angel Tree program, where community members pick up a tag listing a child's age, sex, and other information.
The banks put the trees up on December 1st, and that's when we put our tags out. But we've had people coming in November asking us if they could get Angel Tree tags early because they were either going down south or different things going on, and they wanted to be able to purchase gifts early.
One of the Salvation Army's most visible fundraisers is the Red Kettle Drive. Lieutenant John Burke says some communities have to hire people to staff the kettles. But in Petersburg, it's an all-volunteer effort, allowing more money to go to those in need.
We do fund our food baskets as well as any extra toys we may have to purchase for Christmas, as well as throughout the year for assistance.
That includes temporary housing and helping people develop plans to improve their situations. Misty Burke says Petersburg continues to respond to those in need.
We could not do any of what we're doing this season or any season without the help of the community and their generosity. They just give on a daily basis and they just continue to give.
The Salvation Army is still collecting toys, money, and other donations for its holiday programs. In Petersburg, John Burke says the last week before Christmas often brings the largest amount of Red Kettle cash. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
A Wrangell artist who creates fused glass artwork and jewelry has been a fixture at community markets and bazaars in town. But this December, Magpie and Squid owner Chris Reed decided to open a store for just 1 month to sell her artwork and teach art classes. KSTK's Katerina Sestarek has the story.
The front room of the Magpie and Squid shop is full of shiny, colorful artwork made of fused glass, decorative plates, jewelry, fancy nightlights, picture frames, and embellished serving utensils. Women arrive at the shop and head into the back room, which is where they'll create their own artwork at a class taught by shop owner and artist Chris Reed.
So we have classes on how to do lanyards and reader keepers, and then other things are a scarf necklace, which is a number of strands of beads that tie kind of like a scarf and have a number of different ways that you can wear it.
Today I'm working on a wire-wrapped cake server, and I've made several things from the last class. This is actually the second time I'm taking the class, and today I'm making something for me. The others were gifts.
Vicki Bunis Taylor says Reed makes it easy for class participants to create beautiful art, and she enjoys having the space to work in a group.
I'm pretty much rented a space now, and I'm just planning to be here anytime the shop is open.
She says more people should try the classes, even if they don't think they would be successful.
We've had just such a great time, and everybody from, we've had a couple young girls to people like myself, some with experience, some without any experience, and seriously, everything has turned out wonderful. People have been really proud of their projects.
Reed says she thought it would be fun to open a store just for the month of December, and she's loved the experience so far.
Just being able to put everything in the space and leave it for a whole month for me was a little bit euphoric because I'm so tired of packing glass in and out and in and out. So it's been fun to have the store, but even more fun has been the classes and having people come down and just visit and work and I guess play would be a better term for it.
Reed says having the shop has spurred conversations about the possibility of starting an artist's cooperative.
I would love to do this again next year. I'd love to do it all summer, too. And I don't know if that's a possibility or not, but there are a few of us, I think, who are kind of maybe starting to lean that direction. And if there was a space available, we'd really like to have a spot where visitors can come through and really look at what the Wrangell crowd is doing in terms of art.
She says there are many different types of artists in Wrangell, and it would be fun to have a way to support all the talent in the community. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katerina Sestarek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Katerina Sestarek in Wrangell. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.